Let us start. And well, I want to start with one of the remaining heroes, I would say. So you know his name. His name is Kolmogorov. He's obviously Russian, and you know him from the Kolmogorov-Smirnov test. But believe me, he did quite a lot of other things. And as you can imagine, he was sort of the hardcore Russian mathematician. And so here is a list of some of the things he worked on, which still bears his name. And I think, well, I highlighted the Kolmogorov-Smirnov test here, but also the Kolmogorov axioms. Axioms are the foundation of mathematics. Those are the things you state as you consider this to be true, and then work on from there. And so typically what happens in math, statistics as well, is that you don't know which axioms to rely on, but you slowly fumble your way backwards to see on how few axioms can we base the whole of statistics. And you can imagine that's a tough and really hardcore mathematician task, but Kolmogorov became the guy doing it mainly for statistics. So yeah, he's widely renowned. But I think to most people dealing in statistics, Kolmogorov-Smirnov test is what really does the trick. And with that, you can test if two distributions come from the same underlying distribution or not, and give it a p-value, because the distance between the two integrals can in fact be related to a known distribution from where you can do the integral out, as we always do with the chi-square. More advanced and modern methods do exist, but they are not as robust, and they are computationally heavy, because if you want a p-value, then you don't have the distribution, and you will have to simulate your way out of that. So the Kolmogorov-Smirnov test still stands due to our hero, Andrei Kolmogorov. All right. Assuming no questions to Kolmogorov, I'll move on to today's subject, which is the problem set. And I can in general say that we're very happy. So, but let's go through that slowly and surely. All right. So I will go through first some general considerations, and then I'll go through the problems, each and every one. And then I'll go through the scoring and a few other details. And then in the end, I will post your scores according to your Swedish license plate. And these will remain also on the web version for 24 hours, after which I won't show them anymore. The problem is, we want you to have the number of points you were given for each and every problem. But feeding that back, and you can imagine here we're into several thousand numbers, is not a simple task, but we wanted you to have them. So this is the way we're doing it. And copy down your own line, and then sit and look at that. And I should also state now that the persons who corrected and gave you points are, well, very much an expert on that problem. And if you think that you, unless you think there's a downright error, then I would say don't complain. The thing is, even if you were given half a point lower than you expected, then so were everybody else, because they were very, very uniformly corrected. And the final grading is given relative to everybody else anyway. So if everybody got half a point less in one of the problems, that doesn't change a thing. But let's go to it. First, some overall comments. And you're welcome to ask questions throughout, but the overall comments are on how to hand in also the exam. So first of all, make solutions clear. And here I just show two examples, and I hope that you see which one is the more clear one. Remember, we, and in especially the censors, will sit and read through all of this. And if they can't see what your solution is clearly, I would say in general, that's not going to benefit you. So please be clear. And also, please do not include code. I'll return to that point. So also, give rationale, not story. And I'm just showing you one page here where I would say that's simply too much writing. So you need to give the rationale. This is binomial because I consider the errors Gaussian, the p-values below, and quantify your answers. It's the quantification that is the answer, saying that this is most likely based on no numbers does not give you any points. And you do not need to derive or write the basic equations. You don't need to write those. If you state, I use a weighted average, well, then everybody knows what you're doing. Even people outside this course, everybody else will know what you're doing, or they can look it up, and you don't need to state that equation. And don't give a long story. To some extent, much of science is to give a short and concise answer. And do not include any code. And if you, for some reason, invented an entire new, super smart way of solving a problem, then it should be short and very well reasoned and not be beyond 5 lines of code. Otherwise, for the exam, you submit the code and you may make a reference to lines in your code. So that's fine. And a question is, then what about error propagation formulas, integrals, and so on? Should we state those? Well, if you're making an integral, you should state that integral. And you can just write again, I used the error propagation formula on this and obtain. And then you don't need to show the general error propagation formula. You just need to show the case you have at hand. And if you really want to make it specific, you can say the error propagation formula, assuming no correlations or with correlations. All right. Then finally, you don't need to repeat the problem, but rather state your answers. So as long as you write 3-1-1, then we know what problem we're talking about. And you can say using X, start on your solution, not the restate the problem, I would say. Though that's not as bad, but those correcting it will really quickly know what problems are which problems are which. Then, one main detail, which most of you caught on, but a few misunderstood, and I understand why, and there were several of you, hence I was not clear enough. Sorry about that. But we talk about small statistics, and it's small counting statistics. So the case of the planets is not small statistics. The uncertainties in the planetary case were all Gaussian. Small statistics only refers to counting statistics. So for example, entries in a bin in a histogram. Because if it's small counting statistics, then the errors are not Gaussian, right? It's a Poisson number, and only for higher values, 20 or above, are they, or 10 or above, are they Gaussian or relatively Gaussian. If you have 4 out of 1 million in a bin, well, then clearly it's a Gaussian number, but the uncertainty or the distribution around 4 is asymmetric and discrete. And I mean, there are all sorts of things that makes this non-Gaussian. And that is what is meant by small statistics. Not the fact that we only have 5, 6, or 7 other planets to look at. And then just a drawing thing. careful of putting straight lines between your points. It's not, I mean, everything else in this case was right, but drawing a model like that is actually drawing it wrongly because it's not linear between these points. Now, I had come across another figure which was on the Hubble tension, where the 7 points had been connected with a line. And I wanted to show this also here, but I couldn't find it again. And I thought, look, I will find another version of it if I look through. I think I looked through 30 solutions and I didn't find a single. I had a hard time in general finding bad figures. And so you should be proud. I was proud. I thought you did really well on making things illustrative and having the right, both binning and range, and they were very illustrative. So thank you very much. Please continue that. That always impresses censors. And they know that making figures takes a while, and doing so in an exam situation impresses them. So don't hold back on that. Okay, then a mixture of remarks. In problem 3, the one on Monte Carlo simulation, some solutions failed to calculate the mean and the standard deviation. And I suspect that it's because suddenly it was not from a sample, so you are given 1,000 X values, but because it was a distribution. In the distribution case, it simply becomes an integral. This was first day of first week, Monday. But you integrate over the range allowed and you weigh X by the PDF f of X. And for the standard deviation, well, for the variance, you could say it's the integral and you weigh X minus the mean squared. So X minus the mean, the whole thing squared by the PDF and integrate again. So if you're in doubt what I'm saying here, look that one up. Now, if you do a Fisher transformation, then please include either a histogram of the distributions projected onto the new Fisher axis or a value for the separation you achieved, and preferably both. That's better than just a rock curve. Of course, a rock curve is nice. Very good. But it's so easy to say, well, let me plot these in a histogram. And please include that because that shows very easily that what you did worked, and it's very convincing. Again, the clear solution. And then every time you calculate a weighted mean, include both the value of the mean and its uncertainty and the chi-square and the probability. That's just fixed standard procedure. You don't combine numbers that you don't know if are consistent. So that's how you know if they're consistent. All right. When you say a value for the separation, do you mean a 2-sample z-test? That might be it, Marcus. That could be an example. I would almost say anything. It might also be that you, in the plot, put a line or just state in the text, if I cut at 3, I get 8 out of 200 correctly identified or wrongly identified a signal, and you know, state the error rates, anything. And if you were to show me a plot or give me a separation, I would say, just show me the plot. The rock curve will contain the separation. So, but without the distribution, it could be anything that you'd gotten and just shown, put a rock curve, right? We have no clue where that rock curve comes from. All right. And then for readability and happy TAs, and that means happy censors, it'd be great if you could mark either in bold or in color or 2 lines below what your final answer is. That's just good common practice. And then to show you an example, one of the TAs highlighted this one. It's to the Hubble tension question. And here's the following solution. And it's just so easy to see. Okay, all measurements, the first four and the last three. What is the weighted mean? What the error on that mean? What is the chi-square? What is the number of degrees of freedom? What is the probability? Do the values agree with each other? Bang! It's right there. Okay, and then there's another question in the problem set. Wrote in LaTeX, which was fine, but time-consuming. Do you have a suggestion for how to present the exam? Well, I would say regarding LaTeX that if you prepare it, and you probably have by now, Peter and many others, if you have a LaTeX document ready with an empty table, an empty figure, and problem headings down that are just empty, then I think that's probably the fastest way you can do it. You don't have to think about spacing between the different problems and so on. You just, you know, throw in the figures and throw in text there under the right problems. And if you start out by taking the problem set, the exam set, and if you want me to, I'll gladly also put out the LaTeX file, then you can take that and say, I'm going to copy each problem in just to make sure that I answer each problem. Now, I said you don't have to repeat every problem. So, doing so to begin with is perhaps a good way of making sure that you answer that problem, and then you can delete it in the end. I think that's perhaps a good workflow. Yeah. All right. Yeah, please, more questions. I suspect we're going to go through all of this and more again on Tuesday, but please don't hold back. So, you can use the markdown cells in Jupyter and hide the code cells. It makes it a bit coherent to write and faster for me that way. Sebastian, that is right. Make sure it doesn't end like this, right? Because that contains all the code. But as long as it's readable, it's nice. And there is also, we put that in week zero, in the end of one of the notebooks, there are actually the instructions on how to transform it into a PDF so that it looks nice. And I would say it's perfectly okay to do it that way. Make sure it's clear and make sure that it's a technology that you master before the exam. So try it out. Yeah.
Can I quickly ask a question?
Please.
So it's regarding, you said that we should kind of mark our final answers in bold or whatever, make it clear that this is the final answer.
Yeah.
But for some questions, at least I had the impression that it wasn't like a single number or a single thing, but it was more like, you know, do this fit or like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, in that case, I would just show the figure. That's fine. I mean, figures you don't have to put in bold or anything. It's just if you're giving, you know, if this is the page, right, then putting two lines underneath here makes it very readable what your answer is, and also up here.
Right.
Or putting it in bold or something like that.
So it's more like, if the answer is like a single number or right, okay.
It doesn't have to be for each and every single damn thing.
Right.
And fortunately, this one is very clear. So here, even if it's not there, it's relatively clear, but they're not all that clear.
All right, thank you.
And digging for the answer here, and I can show you many other examples, is a little more challenging.
Right. Cool, thanks.
You're welcome. All right. Yeah. is it sufficient to give the answers in a table like the one you just showed without writing additional explanations? I'm inclined to say yes, but for this table, I would say, I mean, without any explanation is a strong term, but ahead of this table, for 2-1, the text could be, you will find the results to 2-1-1 and 2-1-2 in the table below, where I have used the weighted average, calculated the chi-squares and their corresponding probabilities, and made a choice based on p-values greater or less than 0.01. If you made those two lines before the table, then I would say certainly enough. So it's a little hard because there might be, you put an answer here, but it's a much more subtle problem, right? And if you didn't give any explanation, then yeah. Could you perhaps explain why a p-value of 0.999, for instance, is a big problem? Yeah, I can. I wouldn't say a big problem, but you cannot get a model which by coincidence happens to be extremely good, like 0.999. You can only get that if you have a good model, a reasonably good model, and you overestimated your uncertainties. It's only by getting larger uncertainties than they really are that you can get 0.999. And so you could say that in that case, you're conservative, right? You're not overstating something, you're under exploiting your data. So it's not a big problem, but let's say you get this in a problem, then I would at least comment to show the senses that you understand that issue. I would write, I suspect that there is a problem with yielding larger errors than they in reality are. And then if the problem was stated by me and you didn't calculate the errors, then you can just calmly accuse me of having done so. And if you calculated the errors yourself, then I would say go back and have a look at them. And if they're not exactly good enough, then I think you should, I would recheck the errors once more if you got that, if you calculated them yourself. Makes sense. But the conclusion would still be that the model fit the data very well, given the uncertainties. Yeah, yeah. It doesn't indicate to the fact that the model is wrong. But for example, if you 10-double the errors on something, it might be that any model will fit through. Remember the four wavy models with just twice the error, they all passed. Okay, let's dive into solutions. That does not mean that you have to hold back. So the first problem was on Il Clásico, which is the match between Madrid and Barcelona. And it actually happens that they won an equal number of times. So if you throw away the draw games, you have 144 left. And well, here P is a half. So this is a binomial distribution. It can't be a Poisson. And if you say n trials is 144 and p win is a half, then it has this distribution and they won 72 each. There's only one way that can be done, 72 each. And the probability in that bin is 6.6%. So yeah, it's not impossible that it's even after 144 non-draw games. That can happen and actually did. Okay, then there is the, problem inspired by Fight Club where they're shooting golf balls at an empty factory. And the chance of hitting a window is pretty small. So if you want a 90% assurance, reassurance, or risk, whatever you want to call it, then you need to say, you need to ask yourself, how many balls do I need for this to be above 90%? And that can be solved in several ways. You can say, this is a small probability, but it's not that small. So it's binomial. You can also say it's small and they need to hit many times. So it's Poisson. And in Poisson case, you get 43 instead of 42. And you can also solve it without doing any of this, because you can say, well, if P has to be greater than 90%, and what's the probability of having smashed a window? Well, after N trials, the chance of not having smashed a window is 1 minus P hit to the N trials. And so the chance of having smashed one is 1 minus that. And then you start with the logs getting it down, and in the end you get this. And you get 41.5, but you need to be above at least 90%, so that's 42. Now, notice very much, when I write things like at least, you really need to read that, because if you rounded this down to 41, let's say it was 41.1 and you rounded it to 41, then you would be losing not all of your points at all, but you would be losing some from just not reading that number, that phrasing. So believe me, that I put a lot of effort into the phrasing. First of all, to make it clear and to make it specific, but you also need to read that. And then I would say, had you written 41 here, then I'd probably give you 3 out of 4, simply because you show all the logic and explain all the things that you're doing. And if you tend to solve things in two ways, A, that's good for cross-checking. B, it impresses the senses. And there's no limitation to how many points you can score in a problem. So if you had done it in two very nice ways and illustrating it, then you could easily get 5 out of 4. Ah, easily, but you can't get 5 out of 4. We give that. All right. Could you also say that the probability of not hitting should be less than 10%? Yes, you could. Just make sure you phrase it so that the reader understands how you're looking at it. All right. Here are 7 measures of the Hubble tension. And the thing is, it's a real problem. There are 2 methods, and they each show, well, one type shows a high value, and another type shows a lower value. And they simply don't correspond. And I think this is a nice figure because it shows all 3 values. It's interesting that the weighted mean is very much closer to all of these, but that's because they have much smaller errors. They count a lot. But if you separate them according to method, well, then they agree very much, right? And in the other case, I mean, the probability comes out to be 1 in a million or so. So no chance of that. And this is where some people drew just lines between this. I think don't. It's not a, yeah. Question 2.2 had 3 parts, and that gave you, the last one gave problems. So you have a charge and you put it at a distance, and most of you got the error propagation formula nicely and so on. And in the end, you get a charge of 2.0 with some uncertainty. And then comes the question, which term is it, the distance or the force, which gives rise to the largest uncertainty? And when you want to know how much each term contributes, you can just look at it as if all the other terms didn't exist, that the error from them were zero. Because it turns out that 0.3 is 0.18 squared plus 0.26 squared, and then square root of that, right? These two in quadrature. And it's the contribution from the distance, which is the largest. So notice that it was, you know, the non-squared that I was also asking for in the project when I wanted you to state the influence of each input measurement. So I know a lot of you did it squared, and that must have been me not being clear enough. All right, so you have a larger error from the distance. Well, how can you measure the relative distance better? Well, if the uncertainty on the distance doesn't depend on the distance, it's just a fixed number, then moving it further away will give a smaller relative error. However, and this is the key thing, as you move the charge away, the force on the charge becomes smaller. And so the error from the charge term should increase, right? So this decreases and this increases as you move it away. And before we get to that, there were people who also solved it numerically just to check if the errors were actually Gaussian. I think this impresses to do that. So if you do it by simulation, don't hold back in showing the distribution. You don't need an insert plot and all that. But showing the distribution with a Gaussian distribution put on top and commenting on the Gaussianity of the uncertainties afterwards. That's always cool. So, but many of you got this expression and then you said, well, I see D here. And if I take D to zero, then this becomes small as possible. But that's because you have to realize that F changes with distance. And so the force becomes very large and grows faster than that becomes small. And so this term will come to dominate if you go very close. So you have to substitute this with whatever D gives. And well, you make the substitution and you get something lengthy, admittedly. But in the end, you can see the error has a minimum out here at some point, and the uncertainty here is that size. And it's great to do things both analytic and numerical, even if, alas, in this case, none of the two were actually, they weren't far off, but they didn't agree and they were not, none of them were right. But I think it's really good to put it. Because you do showing these two ways of doing it shows that you master it. That you got it wrong, well, that's going to count down anyway. Do you need uncertainty on which D gives the lowest uncertainty? No, I didn't ask for that. I know that some people calculated it, and I think that's cool and impressive if you can include it, but that was not required here.
Can I ask a question about that, Troels?
Please.
So I'm just a bit confused about when you ask for an answer, when is the uncertainty then required? You know what I mean? Like, is it?
Yeah,
just...
yeah. I would say always, except when it's very hard.
Okay, thanks. So when you ask for the mean, then uncertainty on the mean, of course.
Yeah, That's an obvious. But I think if you can state it in any way, do it. In some problems, we know that this is hard. And so if it's hard, then it wouldn't be required. But if you state it anyway, well, that's an extra point right there. And it's not impossible in this case, right? Because you get an expression for D giving this in terms of all of these things where you know the uncertainty. But I think this is the first case where you don't need it, where it's not required, where it won't count down if you don't.
All right, thanks.
Of course. Then the Neanderthal DNA. Here's the distribution, and people could calculate, thank you, both a mean and a root mean square error, a standard deviation, a root mean square, whatever you want to call it. And it's nicely shown here. And well, there are negative values in it. Thank you for noticing that. There are also other strange values. Now, there are quite a few halfway down. Now, those are to represent people who have one parent which are sub-Saharan and one parent that is not sub-Saharan, right? You would expect roughly half there. So, and if you fit it with a Gaussian, then it doesn't give a very good probability, right? It even throwing away all the other things, it's just not right Gaussian. And you can test that both by fitting it with a Gaussian, which I think is a reasonable thing to do. You can also do the Anderson-Darling test if you feel like it. Now you've seen that on Tuesday. And don't hesitate in doing both if you got the code ready for it. Now, a double Gaussian is a good fit to it. And actually, here I have something to admit. That is because I generated the data with a double Gaussian. And then you might say, it's fake data, you don't have it. I do have the original. There's a professor in Aarhus who did this, and I managed to get hold of the data, and I thought it was great. And then I fitted it, and it fitted actually to a single Gaussian, which made it a boring problem. So I simply had to reinvent the data. Sorry for that, but the real data is actually nicely Gaussian. So now you know that this is something I put in. And there are many different nice ways of showing it, you know, showing how much of Gauss 1 and Gauss 2 do I get. And people also tried other things, which works well, a skewed normal distribution. And people also tested it very nicely, a log normal compared to the cumulative data, doing a KS test of that. I think this plot is one of those which just warrants extra points. This is really nice. This is really impressive. And I can see that some of the sensors will sit around and ask themselves, even if they're old, do you understand what's going on here? And they will say, yes, don't worry. Could you make it as nice with the time given? The answer would frankly be no. All right. So that was 2-3. And I had one more comment to it. When rejecting other points, making a plot is just good. I mean, a plot makes it quite apparent what is going on and where the data points really are. And remember to argue in terms of how many sigmas are they away, or do they not even make sense, or so on. Make sure that you quantify why you throw them away. All right, and there's a question I missed. Just to make sure, if you have a mean and a standard error on the mean and a standard deviation, to calculate how many sigma something is away, you use the standard deviation. Yeah, not the standard deviation on the mean, the standard deviation, right? So in this case, here's the mean, here's the standard deviation. And so this would be 2 sigma, 3 sigma, 4 sigma away. So in that case, you might say, okay, it's unlikely to encounter any of these, or at least you might reject the negative ones based on just, you know, the fact that they don't make sense. And then you calculate the mean and the standard deviation, and now you can reject more. And also from the plot, I think it's cool to comment, if you know anything about DNA, that these are probably in the middle. But from showing here that there are clearly a main population and some outsiders, and 4-sigma is what you choose. Is there a way to see that you should use double Gaussian, or is that just trial and error? That is just trial and error, right? And it's not, well, you start with a Gaussian, and that's why I ask that, right? And you see that doesn't fit. And then it's just trial and error. You know, it looks as if you shift that over, but then you miss something here, maybe a double Gaussian, but maybe a skewed normal, maybe a log normal. I mean, I usually don't make it a thing that can only be fitted by one thing. And in the case of the two Gaussians here, I'd also say, if you want to impress the sensors, then show the covariance of the fit. Right, and comment on how correlated things are. I think that's also an impressive thing, but by no means expected, okay? By no means. What about when you propagate errors and one of the variables is achieved through meaning some data, meaning taking the mean off some data? Should you use the error on the mean for the propagation or the standard deviation? Here you should use the error on the mean, right? Just as in the pendulum experiment, you were four persons who measured, say, the length, and you calculated the mean and the error on the mean, and that is your best estimate of the length and the uncertainty on the length, and you continue with the mean and the error on the mean when you propagate further up. You give new meaning to the word meaning. Problem 3.1. And I can see we're running way over time, but I assume we just continue here. Is there an easy way to get an error on a calculated standard deviation? Yes, that is in chapter 5 of Barlow under estimators. And it's also at the end of the slides on mean and width in Monday of week 1. Problem 3.1.
Can you repeat that, the last thing where you said you could find it?
Yeah. Barlow, chapter 5, Barlow always, it is page 78 to 79 and equation 524. And it's also in week 1, Monday, in the slides on mean and width towards the end.
Thank you.
Of course. Problem 3.1. All right, first you have to do these integrals that we talked about. Well, first it isn't normalized, so you need to find the normalization constant. Well, the integral has to be 1, so c can be obtained by that. And then you have to calculate the mean is found by calculating this and the variance this. Yes, cool. Is an error on the standard deviation not required in for the instance of the Monte Carlo problem? No, it's not. That's an exact number. The limits there are different than the ones we were given, right? Yeah. Sorry. They are. I changed the limits. I didn't substitute this one. I do subtle changes of the exam. It takes a long time to make these. So I do subtle changes to see if, as a cross-check, I do several changes. Some are very subtle, some are very clear. This is one of the clear ones. It looks different. So in this case, it could be integrated and inverted, but it was not a nice expression when you did so. I think if you can, you should do it and show it, but it's okay to continue with the accept reject method. And then there's a question, when did root mean square go from root mean square to become standard deviation? root mean square error, standard deviation, and width are terms used for the same concept interchangeably. However, root mean square is what is meant typically in these integration problems, whereas standard deviation is typically something in a data set where you have measurements. But I think from field to field, the usage and the choice of words changes. Yeah, and resolution. Thank you, Jakob. That also goes in there. Though resolution is typically, well, it's very related, I would say. All right. People did very nice showing of the different distributions and how they generate them. You don't need to do that. The cool thing is when you've done it, you just dig that one out and apply it. And then there was the problem of how many measurements did you need in order to obtain a certain precision? I think this plot shows it nicely, right? I take a sample size of this and I record the error and a sample size of this and a sample size of this and that and that and that. And then I see when I'm there. And you see how they go down like square root of n, but they do have some jitter around. How do you get the error on this? Well, here, this is the error shown, right? You make the fit and you record what C1 is and what the error on C1 is, and then that's what you show here, the relative uncertainty.
But then let's say, Truls, that I say, okay, I need 50,000 values to get a low enough error. Then, I mean, the 50,000, that could be like plus minus something, right?
Yeah, and this is, again, a problem where I would say finding the uncertainty on that is damn hard.
Yeah,
right? Exactly. And a long... and the uncertainty is not wanted, asked for. I even think I stated the question as if in roughly.
Good, good, good. Thanks.
Which clearly shows you should know the 1 over square root n law. But if you don't, well, if you don't do it exactly correctly, then don't worry. If you're planning an experiment, this is nice to know, right? What ballpark should I be aiming for? Then there was the problem of separating cells by transparency and length. And I think, doing a scatter plot or a plot of some kind of this type is nice to do. And you see how they separate here, and it's not clear which one is the better one. And it turns out that the original length here is slightly better than for the transparency. But when you combine the two into a fissure, you get a better one. And here's the hypothesis that L is less than 9 microns that gives that point. Should you in general put error bars on all histograms? Well, I know it's done here. Here I would say we're not preparing for a fit of any of these, so that would be fine without error bars. I would say in this case, when you show a fit on top, it's nice to show the error bars because here you want to make it clear where the error bars come from and that they're square root of the count. And it's nice if you write it also. I think everybody will assume it, but if you show it this way, it can be checked, right? It should be so that the reader can know what you did. All right. There was even somebody who found time to try to solve this with a machine learning algorithm. And interestingly enough, the machine learning algorithm came out in red here. So the fissure beat it for this. But it's a good problem for the fissure, right? Because there is an axis here which is quite good. It's a relatively linear problem. It's not entirely linear. And the sample is probably so small that the machine learning algorithm has a hard time. Somebody illustrated the fissure quite nicely, I think. This was one such case. But be reminded of the, it's nice to see the histogram of the fissure as it comes out. I haven't even included an example of that. Shame on me. Then we get to problem 5.1 of the planets. And here, when you fit things, show the residuals to begin with, you know, the chi-square value comes out to be way too good. And it was meant for you to have to comment on that. So, and then you were asked to calculate the mass of the sun. And here's somebody who's giving what I would say would be way too many decimals. I know you can be under time pressure, but this leaves an impression that you don't know anything about significant digits. So that's a little excessive. People asked, what is the error on the mass of the sun in Wikipedia? Because I can't compare. And the answer is there is no error. Somebody probably has it, but it's not quoted simply because it's quite small. In question 5, what would I say here about the chi-square? How would I comment? I would comment on the fact that, first of all, the model seems to be doing very well. It matches the data. Looking at it, the errors seem excessive, which the chi-square also points to. Probably the errors stated in the problem were estimated to be too large. And also here, we're at sub per mil. So the chance of this being just by coincidence, no, I don't believe it. I hope that answers your question, Sarah. Right, if it's 98%, you might say, well, you know, they were pretty lucky, but it's not impossible. But this is, you know, a factor 100 above. All right, problem 5.2 on calibration. Again, there was a fit to begin with. And here was somebody who said, I'm going to fit it both with a chi-square and an unbinned likelihood. And you get different values because the chi-square is good at not feeling these, whereas the unbinned likelihood wants to feel these. Well, it can't avoid it. So it's certainly not Gaussian. And then I'm sorry, I switched the two columns. Well, what happened was I switched the text to make it more fluent in my mind, but I didn't switch the two columns. And also for the exam, I tried to provide code that reads the data. And so once you have that, it's explained in the code, you know, what you're reading, but it wasn't in this case. There were 14 of you, so 10% roughly, that didn't discover and didn't read what I wrote out or too late that it was switched and in various ways tried to answer the questions. And as long as you applied the correct methods and got the correct conclusions, given the slightly strange data, that is fine. So, now it turns out that with the question whether things were symmetric in phi around pi halves, I thought people would immediately apply the Kolmogorov-Smirnov test. You just take one half and plot it on the other side and do that way. But it was probably more apparent to me, also because I designed the problem, than it was to you. But people did smart things otherwise, saying, you know, let me for each half get the mean and the standard deviation and, you know, fit it and see if I got a slope. And people did different things, but many of you did the Kolmogorov-Smirnov knowing that just because I'm not given two histograms, which a priori are right on top of each other, then I can still do it. All right. And then comes the calibration. And there are several things to comment on. Do you want to use the RMS or error on the mean when testing if there's a dependency? And here I would say it's the error on the mean. We also had that in the calibration exercise. It's the error on the mean because this shows how much, when theta is this value, what is the average measurement of something that should be one? Well, it's 1.09 with a small uncertainty, not the large one. Also, what do you do about these bins here, right? That they are, well, quite noisy. I think the person who did this did the right choice of just saying, look, I fit this part. It probably continues like that. Sometimes you can make the binning rougher out here, or you can just make it into one big bin. But I think this was nicely done. And then also in time, and I think this is classic for experiments, you run an experiment and you keep taking measurements. And then at some point you realize, have things been drifting? And you look at it and lo and behold, they have been drifting. And then you correct for it and you also find the reason and then things are more steady. So I think this solution is really beautiful where people say, all right, here's the uncalibrated, then I calibrate with respect to time, with respect to energy and time, and in the end, with respect to angle, energy and time. It's just a beautiful showing of it. And at the end, there was one courageous student last year who wrote the following quote. Doing statistic problems during the entire night is like partying. You can't stop yourself, but the next day you feel miserable. And the person put in 42 pages, which I think is the longest exam I've seen to date without code. Now, the reason why it was so long was that he exactly had done what I proposed, namely prepare a LaTeX file with the problems ready and so on, ready to just throw things in there, and he it could answer that. He just threw things in and a lot of figures and didn't care about the distance between them, and that's fine. Okay, I'm gonna show just a little statistics to give you from last year, just to show you. Here's the distribution and number of pages in the solution. And so I think, you know, 10 to 15 is probably the good range. Size-wise, they're typically very different. You don't have to worry about that, some people did very large scatter plots and they take a lot of space. Then we do a lot of cross-checks in the exam. For example, we test the difference between teachers and censors. And so this is the difference, and you can see that the censors were actually nicer than we were on average by 3 point something out of 100 roughly. And also the sigma shows that we have a 5% offset between us. Divided by square root of 2 means that the uncertainty on the final number of points is roughly 3 points. We also correlate it with your problem set to see if there's anything strange in the corners. We also correlate it between teachers and censors. And then we take all the code that you have to submit and run it through something called a measure of software similarity. And so for every pair of you, we get a ranking of what the overlaps in code are. And then you might say, ooh, this looks dodgy. Well, all those with large overlaps and a random sample, we look into. And it turns out that, and we have several ways of doing this. it turns out that typically that's because people who worked together before, not on the exam, had built up a code library that they had in common. And they both used parts of that. But we look into code to check that none of it is specifically related to the exam. So we go through that. And then finally, and Bea, in answering your question, let's get to the results and then take a long break. Here is how many points people, and there's a question, will it be okay to submit multiple code files? Yeah. You can submit anything, I would say. I don't know what the KU size limitation is. And I would find it strange if you submit in more than 3 different languages, but you may submit any number of code files. There's no reason to make it excessively difficult for us to see, but you shouldn't worry about that. You should just dump whatever you have, okay? Here is how many points out of how many did people get on the different problems? There's the 2, 2, 3 here on the distance, which gave the smallest uncertainty. That gave rise to problems, but otherwise everyone was above 50% for all problems. And Sebastian asks, are we allowed to use stuff from the code library that you have given us, external functions? Yes, Sebastian. I'm going to rewrite that. But yes. And that's why it's natural to have some overlap. The point of all that code is that you learn to use it and do use it in the future. This, I hope, is your toolbox that you carry with you. And if you one day meet somebody who solves things in the same way, who knows, you might have taken the same course, or you just, this is the standard way of solving it. But yes, please drag that along with you and use it at will. Copy out and say, ha, that looks like another problem I did. Make a copy of it and start running. Where's the access label? Yeah. sorry, it was not put in by the Excel. And in general, I wouldn't have chosen this color set for it if I had a choice. What is the third yellow problem? I think that was the last one in 5, 4, 1. Could that be? Or the last one in the Monte Carlo? Okay, I only noted that. And also that there's a slope going down here, which I want to comment on, because what you should do is read the whole problem set to begin with. And not start from an end, because in the end, even in 5-2, the first question is typically solvable and they give roughly equally many points. So make sure that you solve also all the simple ones, even if you think the last one is, oh, that's not for me. Here is the score distribution. And you first of all, notice that there's no access labels. Here's your scores, here's the frequency. And you also notice that this was again an external program that chose the bidding. I had no say in it. There are quite a few people who follow the course on the sideline, so they don't take it for credit. And there are a few who dropped out. They all figure in here. So that's why there's 24 here. The average from the rest was 72. And I think the distribution is quite nice. Most people get what I would call a Gaussian around 80. And then there's unfortunately a tail down. And to those who think they got a relatively low grade, but really want to go at the exam and do something about it, make sure that you join us in the exercises and ask questions on the exam. On the problem set. Because I think that's the best way to sort of find out how and why you didn't score that high. And most likely you know it, but don't worry. But please join us in the exercises. We can make breakout rooms. And then, as I said, for 24 hours, all the scores are shown here. So you look up your KUID here, and I think it's roughly alphabetic by last name, roughly. But there's no guarantee that it's that way. So this is given in all of these. And my apologies to one person. We simply are missing these. So we will return with that, and I'll write you personally. But we just didn't get the scores in time. All those in purple were people who had switched around in the two columns, or not discovered that I had switched around. Sorry, that's the right way to say it. And here's the scores for each problem. I think you should record those down real quick and sit and see where you got points and where you lost points and so on. And at the top is how many were assigned to each problem. So yes, you see people getting more points than were assigned. That's not impossible. All right. With that, I think we definitely need a break here. What does an 80 correspond to on the 12-point scale? Yeah, I can't answer that. Because what happens is that you have a project, you have a problem set, and you have an exam. And we make a weighted average, and also you have a score from the census, and you have a score from the teachers. And we weigh all of that into a final number of points. And then the censors decide what points correspond to what grades. And then we look at, after they decide first round, we look at how does that correspond to previous years, and the census changed, so they don't know from last year what it was. And I can say that it usually switches 1 to 2 points, and that's it. And off the top of my head, I think that the typical cutoff between 10 and 12 has been around 91 or 92, but plus minus 2 or 3. And the typical cutoff between 10 and 7 has been around 80 to 81. And then when we set it again in light of previous years, we then go through each and every person who is just around, and we evaluate what we really think is the score. And we relook at your exam set to see if the conceptual points, did you understand what a p-value was? Were you able to fit? Can you do a hypothesis test? And then we assign the final grades. So it's a lengthy and detailed process, and so I can't answer that. Yeah, and Susanna says, if you feel that something went wrong, you're welcome to come back. But a word of warning, as I said in the opening, it has been done by those who are experts on the problems, and things are done relatively to everybody. So you should feel that something went significantly wrong before you write. And also, you writing is no guarantee of us changing it, but we will consider. And the problem set is 20% of it. I think it's fair to say it's going to change nothing, unless you find a downright mistake. For example, if you handed in problem 5-1, and you got 0 for all of them, then you might think that is strange. I think there's a problem here. And I think that you should return on. Cool. Any more comments or questions after this marathon run through? If not, well, surely you will have more comments. On Tuesday, we're going to go through the whole thing again, and I'm sure you're going to ask more. And so I think We'll take a good long break here until 10:50. And then from 10:50 on, we're going to do one of the last exercises. It's actually about estimating pi and the volume of, well, hypervolumes using simulation. It's a classic applied statistics type of problem, which is simply just exercising everything that you have learned so far. So, but let's take a break until 10:50. See you then.